sound.
C-K-U-T.
So many people asked me if I could speak up, not only for myself, but for them.
Another State Department official publicly resigns in protest over the Biden administration's support for Israel's assault on Gaza. She'll join us from Washington, D.C. Then, despite an imminent famine, Israel informs the United Nations it'll cut off all UNRWA convoys to the north of Gaza. And President Biden signs a spending bill that strips funding to the UN Refugee Agency for the next year. We'll go to Jordan to speak with UNRWA spokesperson Tamara Al-Rifai. But first, a doctor who spent 2 weeks volunteering and living at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in central Gaza, Dr. Tanya Al-Haj, just left Gaza yesterday. She'll join us from Amman as well. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Al Jazeera has released a video showing Israeli soldiers fatally shooting two unarmed Palestinians near Gaza City, then burying their bodies with a bulldozer. One of the men can be seen waving a piece of white fabric before they shoot him dead. Indiscriminate Israeli attacks continued throughout the Gaza Strip Wednesday. Musa Dahir lost his parents in an Israeli airstrike on Rafah.
I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. I can't make sense of what happened. My parents, my father with his displaced friends who came from Gaza near the industrial area and were staying with him. They were all together when suddenly they were all gone like dust. They fled from one death and came to another. If the Security Council issues another resolution, they will hit more. For God's sake, do not pass more resolutions. That's enough. Every time they pass a resolution, they hit us more. We're all dying. My parents last night. We will be tomorrow. Others will follow. We're all on the way to death.
The Israeli raid and siege on al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City is now in its 10th day. The rights group EuroMed Human Rights Monitor says at least 13 children have been killed by Israeli forces in and near al-Shifa since the raid started. Meanwhile, local media is reporting Palestinian journalist Mohammed Abu Sakhil was shot and killed at al-Shifa Hospital. In related news, the Palestine Red Crescent says Israel recently released seven of its members who were detained on the raid on Al-Amal Hospital in February. The health workers, who included the director of ambulance and emergency services in Gaza, spent 47 days in prison. Eight other Red Crescent staffers are still being held. This comes as UNRWA said 171 of its workers have now been killed in Gaza. The death toll there since October 7th has now topped 32,500, including 14,000 children. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed at least four Palestinians Wednesday. Three of them were killed in an overnight air raid.
I started screaming, and my nephew was with me. I was calling for an ambulance or a car and calling on the people to come and help us to move bodies from the ground. People came to help because the ambulance was late because the checkpoint was closed. We carried Hamza, and he was still breathing, but when we reached the ambulance, he died.
The Palestinian Health Ministry says at least 450 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since October 7th. Another 4,700 have been wounded. Over 7,300 have been detained. Also in the occupied West Bank, the Israeli human rights group Looking the Occupation in the Eye said a shooting attack on a highway near the town of Al-Auja injured two of its activists. They were reportedly on their way to help Palestinian shepherds. A 13-year-old Israeli boy was also injured. Here in the U.S., another State Department official has publicly resigned over the Biden administration's support for Israel. Anel Schelein was a foreign affairs officer in the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, who focused on promoting human rights in the Middle East and North Africa. In a piece for CNN, she writes, quote, "Whatever credibility the United States had as an advocate for human rights has almost entirely vanished since the war began." Anel Schelein will be joining us later in the broadcast. The president of the Center for American Progress, Patrick Gaspard, who is also a longtime Democratic insider and former U.S. ambassador to South Africa, blasted the Biden administration's defense of Israel's actions in Gaza. Gaspard's comments came after State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller told reporters this week the U.S. believes Israel is complying with international law. And Gaspard said Miller's statement is, quote, "a gross disregard of overwhelming evidence and a dangerous precedent in the conduct of U.S. foreign policy." Meanwhile, the White House says it's working with Israel to reschedule a date for a D.C. visit by an Israeli delegation to discuss the planned invasion of Rafah. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had previously canceled the meeting after the U.S. refused to veto a U.N. Security Council ceasefire resolution. Elsewhere, Ireland says it'll intervene in South Africa's genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. The Irish Foreign Minister, Michael Martin, said Israel's actions in Gaza constitute a, quote, "blatant violation of international humanitarian law on a mass scale." In Jordan, police continue to crack down on thousands of protesters who've been demonstrating near the Israeli embassy in Amman for 3 days. Protesters could be heard chanting "betrayal" as they call on Jordan to cancel its deals with Israel.
Our message has been a message of the Jordanian popular movement since the beginning of October 7th and before that. We are asking the Jordanian government to cancel the Wadi Araba peace treaty with Israel and all its annexes that we believe harm Jordanian national interests. This requires us to stand with the choices of the Palestinian people who are facing an aggression by the Zionist entity, the American administration, and the European West.
In Baltimore, rescue workers recovered the bodies of two victims of the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse. The men were identified as 35-year-old Alejandro Hernandez Fuentes, originally from Mexico, and 26-year-old Dorlian Roniel Castillo Cabrera from Guatemala. Another four workers are still missing and presumed dead in the river. All six victims were immigrant overnight construction workers. The National Transportation Safety Board said the investigation into the cargo ship's collision with the bridge could take 1 to 2 years to complete. President Biden has vowed to direct federal funds to pay for the entire cost of the bridge's reconstruction. In Alabama, a Democrat has flipped a seat in the state legislature after running on abortion rights and preserving access to IVF, in vitro fertilization, in what Democrats hope is a bellwether ahead of November. Marilyn Land said of her victory, quote, "Alabama women and families sent a clear message that will be heard in Montgomery and across the nation. Our legislature must repeal Alabama's no-exceptions abortion ban, fully restore access to IVF, and protect the right to contraception," she said. Voting rights advocates in Pennsylvania are expressing alarm after a federal appeals court ruled undated mail-in ballots should not be counted even if they arrive on time. The ACLU said this could result in thousands of Pennsylvania voters losing their votes. The Republican National Committee praised the ruling. Meanwhile, Montana, the state Supreme Court has struck down four Republican laws aimed at restricting the vote, including one which would have largely ended same-day voter registration. The three white men who chased down and killed Ahmaud Arbery in 2020 asked a federal appeals court Wednesday to toss out their hate crimes convictions. The three convicted murderers say prosecutors did not prove they targeted Arbery, who they shot and killed while he was out for a jog because he was black. During the trial of William Bryan and father and son Greg and Travis McMichael, prosecutors shared dozens of racist text messages and social media posts from the men in the months and years before the murder of 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery. Ahmaud's father, Marcus Arbery, responded to the news Wednesday.
The evidence just too strong against the old man. I don't care what them lawyers said. The evidence was just too strong. And me and my family, we just had to be strong to just sit back. We know everything all right. Because I'm telling you, the evidence was just too strong against those three men.
Donald Trump lashed out at New York Judge Juan Merchan and the judge's daughter just hours after the judge imposed a gag order on Trump ahead of his criminal hush money trial next month. On his Truth Social platform, Trump called Judge Merchan a hater and accused him of being biased and conflicted. In response to the partial gag order, Trump claimed Merchan was, quote, wrongfully attempting to deprive me of my First Amendment right to speak out against the weaponization of law enforcement, unquote. The gag order does not technically shield Merchan from public statements by Trump. Former Connecticut senator and vice presidential candidate Joe Lieberman has died at the age of 82 after a fall. Lieberman was a leading backer of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. He also helped kill the public option and the Affordable Care Act and fought efforts to expand Medicare eligibility. In 2000, he became the first Jewish vice presidential nominee on a major party ticket when he ran as Al Gore's running mate. In 2008, he endorsed Republican Senator John McCain for president over Barack Obama. In his memoir, McCain said he was sorry he didn't choose Lieberman as his vice presidential running mate over Sarah Palin. The Phoenix City Council has approved a new ordinance to protect many workers from extreme heat. Phoenix is the hottest city in the country. Contractors working with the city will be required to provide cooling breaks, cold water, and air conditioning. Meanwhile, in Florida, the Republican-led state legislature recently passed a bill barring municipalities in Florida from adopting any local measures to protect workers from extreme heat. In Argentina, a court has convicted 11 former officials of crimes against humanity for committing atrocities against over 600 people during the military dictatorship that ruled Argentina from 1976 to 83. The victims included transgender women, high school students, prisoners who gave birth in captivity and whose babies were taken from them. The court ruled the former military, police and government officials were involved in forced disappearances, torture, rape and murder at secret torture centers on the outskirts of Buenos Aires. On Sunday, thousands of Argentines gathered in Buenos Aires to remember the victims of the military dictatorship.
Today, some families here in Argentina are still searching for their children. The idea is that every March 24th, we should remember that date so we don't repeat those mistakes. A people that has a memory does not repeat those mistakes.
This all comes as Argentina's new far-right president, Javier Milei, faces renewed criticism for downplaying dictatorship-era atrocities. In Indonesia, 13 soldiers have been arrested after video emerged showing them torturing a man at a military outpost in West Papua. The Indonesian military also issued a rare apology for the incident. According to Amnesty International, the man who was tortured later died. In Russia, the death toll from last week's concert hall attack has risen to 143. Around 80 people remain hospitalized after surviving the worst terror attack in Moscow in decades. The arrest of four Tajik nationals has sparked an increase in attacks on Central Asian migrants in Moscow and other cities. The embassy of Tajikistan in Russia has warned its citizens to stay home if possible. And UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for reparations for the transatlantic slave trade to, quote, help overcome generations of exclusion and discrimination. Guterres made the statement on the UN International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
And Nermeen, belated happy birthday.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you. Nearly 6 months into Israel's assault on Gaza, the health sector has been completely decimated. Before October 7th, Gaza had 36 hospitals. Nearly 6 months later, only two are minimally functional and 10 are partially functional, according to the United Nations. The rest have shut down completely after either being shelled, besieged and raided by Israeli troops, or running out of fuel and medicine. The death toll from the Israeli assault has topped 32,500, including over 14,000 children, with nearly 75,000 wounded. The entire population of Gaza is facing high or catastrophic levels of acute food insecurity, and famine is imminent in the north. At least 27 people, mostly children, have died of malnutrition and dehydration.
In Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, the largest hospital in Gaza, an Israeli raid is continuing for the 10th day. Israeli forces there have killed at least 200 people and detained over 400. Meanwhile, the UN reports that as of Tuesday, Al-Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis has ceased functioning. That leaves the remaining hospitals in Gaza that are able to partially function completely overwhelmed. One of those is the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Our next guest just spent 2 weeks volunteering at and living there with a team of international doctors. Dr. Tanya Hash-Hassan is a pediatric intensive care physician who works with Doctors Without Borders. She's co-founder of the social media account Gaza Medic Voices, which shares firsthand accounts from health care professionals in Gaza. She just left Gaza yesterday. She's joining us now from Amman, Jordan. Tanya, welcome back to Democracy Now! I know you're absolutely exhausted. Can you just share your experiences of the last 2 weeks, what you feel it's most important for people around the world to understand?
Yeah, certainly. Thank you. Just to clarify, I was in Gaza with a charity called Medical Aid for Palestinians UK, MAP UK. It's really difficult to describe in words the horrors that we saw in our 2 weeks there. You know, you watch the news, you have some idea of what you're going to see, but experiencing in real time entire family structures collapsing, entire families being wiped off the civil registry, having to tell a father or a mother that their entire family, their lifelong partner, and all of their children have just been killed and you weren't able to resuscitate them is something that was very difficult to experience and something that I hope I never have to experience again. And frankly, it's something that I just feel ashamed that we're still talking about, 7 months into this. It just is such a stark representation of our failure, of our failure as humanity, that this is not a humanitarian crisis. This is the worst of what humanity is capable of, and it's entirely all man-made. And when you witness it firsthand, it's an unbearable injustice.
Well, Dr. Tanya Hash-Hassan, thank you for that account. If you could also talk about some of the nurses with whom you worked. For our television viewers, you've seen some of the images that Tanya sent to us. And if you could speak specifically about a nurse whose name you cannot reveal for security reasons, who holds in his hand an infant, which we'll show now on screen. If you could talk about the story of what happened with this nurse and the child in his hands.
Yeah, certainly. I think this photo is very representative of the utter exhaustion and yet ongoing determination of the healthcare staff there. Healthcare workers in general have been targeted since day one, as have health facilities. Al-Aqsa Hospital is a smaller hospital in the scheme of Gazan hospitals. The largest two hospitals are first Al-Shifa Hospital and then Al-Nasr Hospital. And as you mentioned in your introduction, both of them have been directly besieged. They've been targeted, bombed, deprived of resources. Their healthcare staff have been forced to flee. Many of the healthcare workers are arrested. They describe changing out of their scrubs or being told by civilians to change out of their scrubs when they're fleeing. We've had civilians give healthcare workers their own clothes so that they're not seen wearing scrubs, because we know that healthcare workers have been systematically targeted in this particular war. So I think I wanted to start by saying healthcare workers are under an enormous amount of pressure. They're directly targeted. These healthcare workers evacuate, travel a very long way, and then ultimately are back at work, work extremely hard, do all that they can to keep patients alive. And in this particular photo, this particular nurse, one of the most hardworking nurses that I worked with, had come to the end of a 24-hour shift, had tried very hard to resuscitate this infant, and unfortunately was unable to, and then just passed out of exhaustion onto the stretcher in front of him, carrying the now dead child. A lot of times we can't even tell the parents that their child has been killed because there are no parents to be found. And that's unfortunately a very common occurrence. In many of the other photos that you'll see in front of you, I'm not sure which photos, Democracy Now!, you're sharing. I can't see them on my end. But you can see the carnage, the very difficult circumstances under which the emergency room department is trying to operate. A lot of the senior doctors have fled. Junior doctors who are straight out of medical school are on call overnight, receiving mass casualties with stories I can share with you, but stories that are very difficult and unbearable to experience, let alone talk about. But I'm happy to share more.
Can you talk about where you stayed, if you slept where you slept?
Yeah, we slept in a room in the hospital. They had the female healthcare workers in one room on mats, and the male healthcare workers in another room. And we basically worked day and night. We had a surgical team with us that operated through most of the night just so that we can get through the very large backload of cases. I mean, this is a very small hospital that has a capacity of about 200 patients and is running with over 700 patients at the moment. And then there are thousands of internally displaced people there as well. So they have a backlog of patients that require medical attention, that require surgical procedures to prevent their wounds from becoming infected, to stabilize fractures. And unfortunately, they don't have the surgical space or workforce to get those cases done. So our team was just trying to offload some of that work. The teams there are also just utterly exhausted. I mean, they've been doing this for over 170 days. We did it for 2 weeks and we're exhausted. I cannot begin to fathom what it feels like for them.
And Dr. Tania Haj Hassan, if you could, you mentioned in the image that you sent us and that we showed of the child in the nurse's hands, you said that there were no parents or family members to whom you could convey the information of what happened to this child. The last time we had you on, you spoke about this new acronym, Wounded Child, No Surviving Family. Obviously, this child was among those. If you could talk about the number of children who were coming in either on their own or who were left on their own.
Yeah, certainly. In fact, there are a number of them that are living in the hospital at the moment and being cared for by strangers or relatives. Often what happens is we'll receive children, dead or still alive. We'll attempt to resuscitate them and we'll start asking around, does anybody know if there's family for this child in the hospital that have come in with the same mass casualty? And we'll have a distant relative look at us and say, like, they've unfortunately been martyred or they've been killed. And so it was a very common occurrence to have a child that we were resuscitating and not know if any of their family were alive, or be told that their family had been killed, or be told that that other woman that we're resuscitating simultaneously on the floor is the child's mother. I remember one incident where we received a young boy who the side of his face had been blown off, and we were providing care for him while providing care for his sister in the adjacent bed. His sister had 96% of her body burned. Their parents and all of their other siblings had been killed in the same attack. And he kept asking for his family. And he had a distant cousin who was at his bedside who kept saying, they're fine, they're fine, they're injured, they're going to be fine. And he kept saying, where's my sister? He could see the patient next to him. He just couldn't recognize her because she was so badly burned. But that was his sister. She unfortunately died despite our efforts. 96% body surface area burn is essentially a death sentence, particularly under those resource circumstances. She died a couple days later in the intensive care unit, and he is still in the hospital receiving reconstructive surgery for his neck and face. But as of the moment I left, his distant relatives hadn't had the heart to tell him that they had all died. He was suspecting it, so when I would pass by to check on him, he would say, I have a feeling my family has been martyred. I wish I had been martyred too. So I think he knows. But it's utterly unbearable. There's another child that has an external fixator, so rods in his leg after some complex fractures, that, you know, lives in the hospital at the moment for ongoing care and is cared for by strangers because he doesn't have any relatives in the hospital. And he his car was bombed as they were trying to flee. And his family was killed, but he still thinks his family is in the north. Other children know that their family has been killed and are being cared for by extended relatives. Fortunately, their faith is strong, and they are able to rationalize in whatever way this is. You're able to rationalize these atrocities. I find them very difficult, if not impossible, to rationalize. This is an utter and complete failure of humanity. And to be frank, I feel ashamed to be an American citizen. I feel ashamed to be part of a society that has allowed this to continue. And I'm very much hoping and looking forward to the moment where we decide to take a courageous stance and put an end to this massacre.
Why did you go back, Dr. Tania Hash Hassan? You have been there a number of times.
So I had been there over the last 10 years to teach. This is an area that's been besieged for 16 years. And you have healthcare providers that are working under unimaginable circumstances before October 2023. And I think witnessing what was happening from a distance thereafter, witnessing the injustice, witnessing the immense pressure under which our colleagues were working, I found it unbearable not to be there with them. And in fact, I probably felt most at ease since October, the moment I arrived in Gaza and knew that I could now actually join them in solidarity in providing care for their patients, because they're doing exactly what we signed up to do in our Hippocratic Oath. And they're doing it with a level of commitment and determination that is incomprehensible. It is so impressive, and yet being attacked and directly targeted. And I think most healthcare workers that I know that are aware of what's happening feel the same way I do and cannot wait to be there in person to provide solidarity, or are providing that solidarity in different ways from a distance.
And as you were treating, Dr. Hash Hassan, as you were treating children, people with such horrific injuries, if you could talk about the kind of equipment you had to work with. There are reports of aid trucks being denied entry because there were basic medical supplies, scalpels, scissors. Explain what doctors there have to work with as they confront these absolutely unimaginable injuries.
So there's certainly a shortage of a lot of things we need to work. And I think at a very basic level, there's just shortage of space. So you can imagine when we resuscitate a single patient that arrives into an emergency department, we put them in a resuscitation bed in a bay surrounded by equipment. That is not at all what's happening in these hospitals. When we receive a mass casualty, the most critical cases get moved into this red area. There are three beds in the red area, and then the rest we resuscitate on the floor in the red area or the yellow zone. And so we'll have amputations that we do on the floor of the yellow zone of an emergency department. And, you know, basic things that we take for granted are just not available. Sterile suture kits, ketamine I have to beg for. It's a drug that we use to provide pain relief and sedation when we do basic procedures. But, I tend to use it on most pediatric cases when we need to do painful procedures in the emergency department. But they're short on supply, so you have to pick and choose which patients you provide it to and how much you provide, because you know that, you know, it's opportunity cost for another patient. And that's a very hard reality, and it's not one that I've had to deal with before in my career, despite working in humanitarian medicine for a long time. We often have to think about resource limitations, but these particular resource limitations are very difficult to bear. And I should mention that Al-Aqsa Hospital is better off than so many of the other health facilities throughout the Gaza Strip that have either been destroyed or are completely cut off. I mean, you think about the north, Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest hospital, and how cut off it's been from the very beginning, or Al-Nasr Hospital that was besieged for so long, and the healthcare staff inside those institutions not having access to food or water for several days and sometimes weeks. That is a much more extreme situation than that which I'm describing to you at Al-Aqsa Hospital, where despite me describing severe resource shortages, we were still better off than many of the other areas in the Gaza Strip.
Dr. Tanya Hajj-Hassan, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Pediatric intensive care physician, was in Gaza for 2 weeks with medical aid for Palestinians. She just left on Wednesday. Co-founder of the social media account Gaza Medic Voices, which shares firsthand accounts from healthcare professionals in Gaza, speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. Coming up, we go to a State Department official who just resigned in protest over the Biden administration's support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Back in 20 seconds. By Vijayer Aruj Aftab and Shahzad Ismaili. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
A State Department official working on human rights issues in the Middle East resigned Wednesday in protest against U.S. support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Anel Schielein worked as a foreign affairs officer in the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor for a year before publicly resigning. In an op-ed published in CNN, she wrote, quote, "For the past year, I worked for the office devoted to promoting human rights in the Middle East. I believe strongly in the mission and in the important work of that office. However, as a representative of a government that is directly enabling what the International Court of Justice has said could plausibly be a genocide in Gaza, such work has become almost impossible. Unable to serve an administration that enables such atrocities, I've decided to resign from my position at the Department of State," she wrote.
Anil Sheilin is the most significant protest resignation over U.S. support for Israel's assault on Gaza since the resignation in October of Josh Paul, the senior State Department official involved in arms transfers to foreign governments. Anil Sheilin joins us now from Washington, D.C. Anil, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you tell us further about the decision you made?
Thanks so much for having me and for your coverage of this issue. I hadn't initially planned to resign publicly. I hadn't been at state for very long, and I didn't think it would necessarily matter. But I decided to go public because when I started to tell colleagues that I was planning to resign over Gaza, so many people's response was, please speak out, please speak for us. Many people are not in a position where they feel they could resign, or they are trying to do what they can on the inside. There's still a lot of important, crucial work the State Department does. And so I decided I would go ahead and go public.
Well, you told, Anil, you told The Washington Post that you tried to raise concerns internally with dissent cables and at staff forums. So what was the result of that? And how are other people within state, as you said, trying to speak out within the State Department to change policy?
Yes, many people are extremely horrified by the U.S. government's position on this horrific conflict and the actions of both the Israeli and the U.S. governments. There is the dissent channel inside the State Department. I co-wrote a cable and signed other cables. There have been forums for State Department employees to speak out. I spoke with supervisors. I was able to speak with senior official about my resignation. I think at the end of the day, many people inside state know that this is a horrific policy and can't believe that the United States government is engaged in such actions that contravene American values so directly, but the leadership is not listening.
I want to go to the State Department spokesperson, Matt Miller, being questioned by a reporter about the internal dissent channel within the State Department and employees raising concerns over the policies.
What is the point of the whole channel? The secretary listens, and we've all reported about various listening sessions between mid-level or like more senior officials with the secretary, more junior officials. If it's being heard, but if it's not taken into account in the policy at all, then don't you think it's a little bit pointless?
So I would disagree with that completely. It is taken into account in the policymaking process. The secretary has heard things in those meetings that he takes on board and that influence his thinking and that he brings to bear in making policy decisions. Now, if what you mean is, are we going to execute a complete reversal of the policy
that we
implemented, are we going to implement exactly some of the policies that the people in these meetings have called for? That's not how this process works. That's not how government works.
No, I don't think that's anyone's expectation.
That's not how any organization works. I dare say any of the media organizations in this room, if reporters go to their bosses and offer feedback and the bosses say, well, that's a good point, we're going to take that to bear, but on the larger policy, this is the decision that we have made.
I didn't suggest, but do you have any examples on, you know, any
yeah.
changes? I
will say with respect to any number of issues, with respect to the delivery of humanitarian assistance, we have heard good ideas from people inside the building who have come and offered constructive feedback, and we have implemented those. Now, there are people that when you say, if the idea is that to the United States to cut off support for Israel, that's just a fundamental policy disagreement. So when you see people who offer interviews that say we want the United States to stop supporting Israel's right to defend itself, that's not something the secretary agrees with. It's not something the president agrees with. And ultimately, they are the ones who have the responsibility of making those decisions.
So, Anil Sheilin, if you can respond to the State Department spokesperson, Matt Miller.
I think American law is quite clear here in terms of the Leahy laws, for example, of that when a foreign military is credibly accused of gross human rights violations, the law is that the U.S. will no longer provide weapons to those units, or 620I of the Foreign Assistance Act, that a government that is blocking American humanitarian aid is no longer eligible for U.S. military assistance. These laws are not being applied. So I think this is not only having a horrific effect on the people of Gaza, but in terms of America's standing in the rest of the world. This administration came in pledging to reestablish American moral leadership, re-engagement with the international community, uphold the law and the so-called rules-based liberal international order. And I think it's just become clear that this administration is not, in fact, carrying out any of those pledges. And, you know, my work was on human rights, which is very important work that the State Department does. But I think on this issue in particular, the political calculus has been that U.S. support for Israel is a better political move. But I think what the administration may be starting to see is they may have made the wrong decision on that politically.
And Anel, can you explain whether there's any distinction made? There's a blanket statement about U.S. support for Israel, but is there no distinction within discussions at the State Department between different forms of U.S. support for Israel? So, for instance, obviously in this instance, the most important question is that of military aid to Israel at this moment.
I should be clear that, you know, my area of focus, Israel and Palestine were not part of my portfolio. I was focusing primarily on North Africa. So I can't speak directly to, you know, some of those conversations. I do think, you know, at the end of the day, the U.S.-Israel relationship is considered of such political importance that decisions regarding it are made at the very top. And so while there are other processes and certainly discussions going on inside state, inside other parts of the government about some of those nuances you were discussing, I don't think we're likely to see any public shift on any of that until those decisions come from the top that they're ready to reimagine the U.S.-Israel relationship.
I wanted to go to another clip of the State Department spokesperson Matt Miller saying the Biden administration has not found Israel's actions in Gaza to be a violation of international law. This is some of what he said.
We have not found them to be in violation of international humanitarian law, either when it comes to the conduct of the war or when it comes to the provision of humanitarian assistance.
That was this week, Anel Sheline. Either violation of international law or when it comes to providing humanitarian assistance. And yet, President Biden says he is building a port because the Palestinians cannot get enough aid.
Exactly. I think that the evidence speaks for itself. We've had, you know, not only the ICJ's ruling, not only the UN Security Council ruling. Clearly, the administration is unwilling to admit to reality. And I just want to reiterate, I think this is not only obviously devastating for the lives of people in Gaza, but is doing incredible damage to America's standing on the international stage. It is incredibly demoralizing for people inside the State Department, many of whom believe very deeply in what America says it stands for. So I'm trying to speak on behalf of those many, many people who feel so betrayed by our government stance.
And Anel, could you explain the effect that the massive protests across the United States have had within the State Department, what discussion there was of them, and then, of course, the uncommitted vote?
So, within the State Department, you know, civil servants are very committed to their role of being non-political, of following the instruction that they receive. You know, within state, people are aware of what's going on outside, but, you know, this is not the first time that people have been involved or had to carry out policies they perhaps did not agree with. And it is something that many of these people have signed up for. This is the role of carrying out America's foreign policy. On this issue, I think because it has been so horrific and because we are seeing such growing political pushback from the American public, people are increasingly frustrated. You know, many other people with whom I spoke said they're considering resigning. But again, it is challenging for someone to, you know, it's not easy to not have a job in this country.
I wanted to quote further what you've said in explanation of why you're resigning. You said you're haunted by the final social media post of Aaron Bushnell, the 25-year-old U.S. Air Force serviceman who self-immolated in front of the Israeli embassy in Washington on February 25th. You quote him, "Many of us like to ask ourselves, what would I do if I was alive during slavery or the Jim Crow South or apartheid? What would I do if my country was committing genocide?" The answer is, you're doing it right now. If you can explain what that meant to you and how people have responded to you.
Sorry. You know, that post, I think, spoke to me and many people who had to really look at what they were doing, and whether, you know, for me, I have a young daughter, and I thought about in the future, if she were to ask me, you know, what were you doing when this was happening? You were at the State Department. I want to be able to tell her that I didn't stay silent. So I know many people who are deeply affected by those words that Aaron Bushnell posted. And I do think people are trying to do what they can. There is still very important work being done inside the State Department. But I do think until our top levels of leadership are ready to make a change, there's very little that the rank and file are able to do.
Anil Shelein, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Anil has just resigned from the State Department in protest of U.S. support for Israel's war on Gaza. She worked as foreign affairs officer in the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor. She's also the first State Department official to publicly resign since Josh Paul did months ago. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we speak to the spokesperson for UNRWA. President Biden just signed off on a bipartisan bill, turning it into law, which says that UNRWA will not be funded by the U.S. government for the next year. Stay with us. Shobedor El Amel, What Harm is Hope, by Darbet Shams. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Narmin Sheikh.
Despite a UN-backed report that found famine is imminent in northern Gaza, Israeli authorities informed the United Nations on Sunday that it will no longer approve the passage of any UNRWA food convoys into northern Gaza. This is Israeli spokesperson David Mentz speaking to reporters on Monday.
UNRWA are part of the problem, and we will now stop working with them. We are actively phasing out the use of UNRWA because they perpetuate the conflict rather than try and alleviate the conflict.
In response to the news, UNRWA Commissioner General Philippe Lazzarini wrote in a social media post, quote, "This is outrageous and makes it intentional to obstruct life-saving assistance during a man-made famine. These restrictions must be lifted." UNRWA is the largest organization with the highest reach to displaced communities in Gaza. By preventing UNRWA to fulfill its mandate in Gaza, the clock will tick faster towards famine and many more will die of hunger, dehydration and lack of shelter, he wrote.
The decision came as President Biden signed a $1.2 trillion appropriations bill that strips funding to UNRWA for the next year. The U.S. first suspended aid to UNRWA in late January when the Israeli government leveled allegations that 12 of the agency's 30,000 employees were involved in the Hamas attacks of October 7th. The unsubstantiated allegation prompted other top donors, such as Germany, the European Union, and Sweden, to cut funding to UNRWA, although a number of countries have recently announced their intention to resume funding. For more, we go to Amman, Jordan, where we're joined by Tamara Al-Rifai. She's spokesperson for the UN Palestinian Agency, UNRWA. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tamara. If you can start off by talking about the significance of what the U.S. has done. President Biden signed off on a bipartisan law that dealt with a lot of issues, but among them, cutting off aid to UNRWA for the next year. And the U.S. is by far the largest funder of this UN Palestinian relief agency.
Thanks, Amy, and thanks, as always, for giving UNRWA this platform. The decision by Congress and consequently by the U.S. government to stop funding to UNRWA this year is a huge blow. There is no sugarcoating. The impact on our finances is huge. And also the impact on the politics around UNRWA, seeing our largest donor and many times our closest partner withhold funding, which means withhold trust to UNRWA, is a huge blow to us. However, I also want to say that in parallel, several governments, European and non-European, have either much increased their funding to UNRWA or have given us money for the first time. Also, we are getting overwhelming individual support donations from $10 to $20,000 to our campaigns and our drives. And that speaks for a sentiment that is also galvanizing around UNRWA, around its role, and mostly around the fact that it is not possible to just decide to pull the plug on a UN agency. Any change to the way a UN agency works, especially as UNRWA gets its mandate from the UN General Assembly, should be discussed at the General Assembly. It is not about one or two UN member states to decide whether UNRWA can continue working or not. This is a global decision. At the General Assembly is where we get an overwhelming vote of support. And that is where such a conversation should take place.
Mara, could you talk about the countries that have that had previously rescinded funding to UNRWA and may now have either resumed it or intend to resume it?
Yes, I can talk about a few countries that just over the last few days made their contributions to UNRWA. Germany, for example, which, by the way, had not really suspended its funding. It just took a little bit of a pause to think. And they just announced, Germany just announced $45 million in income to UNRWA just in the last few days. The same, Canada, Australia, Sweden, and a number of other countries that had initially withheld their funding to UNRWA following these allegations, around 12 of 13,000 staff members in Gaza, now are releasing their funding. But I also want to talk about the role of Ireland or Spain, both of them having much increased their funding to UNRWA and also their political support. The European Union, our second largest donor as a group, did release the large part of its funding to UNRWA. And also countries like Qatar, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and just today Kuwait All of them are supporting UNRWA, and again, income from private sources, from individuals and foundations, has skyrocketed since the beginning of this year, especially now during Ramadan, where many Muslims around the world are looking for a zakat-friendly way, so a way to donate as per Islamic Sharia law. We have this mechanism, and many, many Muslims from around the world, from Malaysia to Indonesia to Singapore, are donating to UNRWA.
Canada as well, hasn't it said it's restoring UNRWA aid?
Sweden, you said? I couldn't
Canada?
Hear you. Oh, yes, Canada did restore its funding, yes.
So if you could say, also speak, Tamara, about the fact that Israel has now said it will no longer approve any UNRWA food convoys to the north. What are the implications of that?
The implications are huge. In the last few days alone, we received five denials to our requests to move food from the south of the Gaza Strip in Rafah to the north. Now, we've also, so we consider this to be a ban on UNRWA's food distribution in the north. The Commissioner General of UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarini, was also denied access to Gaza 2 weeks ago, despite having followed the usual procedures to ask for him and his delegation to go into Gaza. What we're truly seeing here is the space around UNRWA in Gaza is really shrinking, and our ability to adequately continue saving lives is really being obstructed. We're talking here about food distribution to an entire population that is food insecure. Food insecure in lay woman terms means people are hungry. Half of that population no longer has access to any food. There's nothing in their pantries. 75% or more of the population is displaced. Most of these people displaced are now in Rafah, which has witnessed a six-fold increase in the population. Many of these people are in UNRWA shelters where they do receive food, vaccines, and medical treatment. And many, many of them are in tents in Rafah. When I last was in Gaza, what I saw in Rafah was an immense tented community out in the open. Many people have gathered around UNRWA shelters hoping they would receive some of the aid that UNRWA distributes. What's going to happen to UNRWA if we can no longer truly operate?
I wanted to play a clip of independent Senator Bernie Sanders. You know, this was a $1.2 trillion appropriations bill that keeps the government open through October, but it includes stripping funding to UNRWA. The bill vote 74 to 24. Bernie Sanders voted no because of the stripping of funding to UNRWA.
Tens of thousands of people are starving. UNRWA is trying to feed them, and the Israeli government and its allies like AIPAC spend much of their time lobbying to defund UNRWA, the major organization which is feeding starving people. Sadly, tragically, many members of Congress seem to be happy to be part of this starvation caucus.
So, Tamara Arfai, if you can respond, and also the fact that the 30,000-member agency UNRWA is not just supporting the people who face famine in Gaza, but also throughout the Middle East. We're talking about Lebanon and Jordan. We have 30
seconds. That's a great point. That's a great point, Amy, to remind that UNRWA is the agency that is fully in charge of Palestine refugees, from registering them and their descendants to offering a very sturdy education system to them through 700 schools, to offering all primary health care. So stripping UNRWA of funding not only shrinks its ability to respond to the looming famine in Gaza, but also puts at risk the schools, the access of kids to proper education, the vaccines, the mother and child care, everything across the region, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza.
We want to thank you, Tamara Al-Rafai, spokesperson for UNRWA, the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Shufa Dokadus, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Cinema Politica invites you to the theatrical release of Silvicola starting from March 22nd, with opening weekend screenings followed by a Q&A with award-winning director Jean-Philippe Marquis. At a time when the planet's old-growth forests are threatened as never before, Jean-Philippe Marquis has crafted a dazzling and unsettling film essay on forestry practices in the Pacific Northwest, home to the world's tallest trees. Juxtaposing sublime aerial imagery with Velite workplace footage, he meets people whose livelihood is connected to the forest economy and culture, tempering a critique of neoliberal forestry practices with an up-close understanding for people who labor within the system. The opening weekend of Silvicola will take place at the Cinémathèque Québécois and Cinéma Public, with screenings starting from Friday, March 22nd. For more information, go to cinemapolitica.org/film/Silvicola. We hope to see you there.
And when I'm in Montreal, I stay tuned to C-Cut 90.3 FM. Montreal, stay alive. The music.
Party people, then you'll get funky. Yeah, just hit me.
Peace, this is Brother Afro Bambaataa on CKUT Radio, the radio station that's going to blow your mind and give you the soul power, make you move, get crazy. You better be ready. Rah, rah, plan.
Yeah.
Start to chase your dreams about the streets. Make your body.